Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to Exploring the Lord of the Rings. This is session number 89 tonight, as we are continuing to cruise our way through chapter 12 of book one of the Lord of the Rings, a cool 2+ years into our discussion. So don't worry, we have plenty to talk about tonight. I hear that there was some discussion about whether or not we were going to get to the Ford tonight here before we started. And all I have to say is, I think that's an adorable conversation to be having. Let me just say, the phrase that question brings to mind is safe money is the phrase that brings to mind. But anyway, okay, let's get started. Okay, wait, quick, before we get started, just a couple announcements to this week, not so many as last week. I am headed down to Texmoot. This weekend, really looking forward to getting to Texas, hoping to see some of you there. I know that there are some people here. I know Tolkien Maven is working on her paper, revising her paper here for Texmoot. She's going to be presenting, which is great. Looking forward to that. And anyway, so we're going to, I'm looking forward to getting to see a whole lot of people. There's a record attendance at Texmoot this year. Record not just for record not just for Texmoot, but for any of our regional moots. So it's going to be an enormous crowd, more than 100 people coming to Texmoot this year. And that's going to be great. So anyhow, I'm really looking forward to that. It does mean I will be away on Friday, so I won't be able to do my regular Griflet stream for those of you who often watch that. But of course, obviously, I'm here tonight, and I'll be at class tomorrow night too for the Mallory class as well. So those two will be normal, and then no Griflet this week. But it's going to be a great time down in Texas, really looking forward to that. The other thing to point out, our classes just started. It's the second day of our spring semester at Signum University. So for those of you who were thinking of auditing or something, there's still time. Just wanted to let you know our classes remain open for the first couple weeks and then they close. But of course, obviously sooner is better. So I know there are some people who are thinking about either auditing or discussion auditing or something. There's still time to jump in. So just wanted to make sure that everybody was aware of that. And finally, we do have Mythmoot coming up soon in June. I know that registration has been somewhat delayed this year. There's been some kind of negotiations going on back scene here, mostly between us and the venue, trying to sort some things out. But we're close, I think, to that. Just about ready to open registration soon, I hope. And we should have some exciting announcements as well, as we have made some progress towards securing our keynote speakers and everything, which I'm really excited about. Should be a really fun group this year. So we're looking towards the end of June again. Right now, the projected weekend for that is the last weekend of June. 27th through the 30th are the dates we're working on. And again, like, we haven't opened registration yet because there's still, you know, like, it's, we're being careful, right? We're being careful until every, you know, we've gotten everything officially settled, and there are still a couple small things that are sort of up in the air. So as soon as we sort that out, we'll open up registration. So I hope that will be very soon. And there's still, even though we're opening it later this year than we did last year, we still will have an early bird registration period like we did the previous 2 years. So we're working on that. Anyway, Mythmoot is going to be fantastic this year. For those of you who've never been to Mythmoot, it is so worthwhile. It's a 4-day conference. It is like the, you know, the regional moots are like this little taste of the experience, you know. And Mythmoot is just this wonderful. It's like I don't even know what it's like. It's like nothing else. I just absolutely love Mythmoot. All of the intellectual stimulation of an academic conference with all of the fun and camaraderie of a fan convention and homecoming party and gathering of old friends. It is just so wonderful. I look forward to it so much every year. Anyway, all right, we're gonna. So those are our announcements for this week. Let us move on, because the Valori, and the Room of Requirement was so much fun last year. We had a Room of Requirement which Valori was in charge of, and it was fantastic. I really loved the Room of Requirement last year. I even got to sneak off to it once, one of the few times when I found myself by myself, and I sort of sneaked off and was looking at some of the books and stuff that we had. It was really fun. But anyway, okay, so this evening, session 89, in the hands of Glorfindel. What happens when Glorfindel is in charge, right? When your group is being run by an elf lord, what happens? So that's what we're going to be looking at here tonight. I hope we may get through several paragraphs of text. We'll see. JJ, we should do something special for the 11D1st session, shouldn't we? I mean, I was thinking about that today. We're starting to get up. We're starting to get close to that. We'll see. Anyway, okay. So let's see, what was I going to say? Right. I don't know what I was going to say. Let's get to three questions that I wanted to address from the discussion boards here this week. Philip, and we have several Philips involved. So Philip, I'm not quite sure. I'll just call you Philip at the risk of confusing you with all of our other Philips. But Philip was saying, I've been catching up on some recent classes and noticed that in both episode 82 and 83, we see two more instances, one alone and one with Mary, where Strider seeks higher elevation during times of uncertainty. I remember how he had talked back at Weathertop about his tendency to do so, how we had talked about his tendency to do so, and thought these recent examples were rather interesting. Much unlike Weathertop and Emon Hen and possibly Karathras, the two scouting summits in the flight to the Ford both turn out quite well, resulting in him being able to better guide the company. This got me to wondering if these two positive climbs give us a hint at the reason behind his tendency to seek higher elevation during uncertainty, even when it doesn't seem entirely logical. After all, he's a ranger, and I can imagine that for one who wanders about in the wild a good deal, finding a high spot could probably become a routine solution when you don't know what to do or where to go. Is it possible that this practice is what's influencing some of the other choices we see Strider make? I think it's really interesting. You know, I think it's this is true, and you know, Philip was kind of prompting me to think about this both in a literal sense and also, I think, in a metaphorical sense, right? As we think about the Strider's extended career, right? He does have a tendency to go to high spots and want to look around, right, in order to establish his mind, right, his decisions as he moves forward. And when I say thinking metaphorically about that, of course, there's the one where there's one where it's both literal and metaphorical, right? And that's Emon Hen I'm thinking of, right? Because, of course, going to Emon Hen is not just going to a high spot to look around, right? It's the seat of seeing, right? And as we can see from Frodo's experience when he's on Emon Hen, you can see much more than just the vantage point from a high spot from there, right? So his desire to gain the advantage that was sort of magically secured there somehow, right? We don't really know the mechanism of Emon Hen, but however it works, there is this magical ability to see around, probably just to survey around in space, maybe to survey around in time. We'll see a little bit more about that when we get there. But anyway, the point is, why did he do that? Remember the time, right? He goes up to Emon Hen after, so he's pursuing Frodo, right? And Sam is with him at first until he leaves Sam in the dust, and then Sam turns back and figures out where Frodo's going to go, right? But Strider is following Frodo's footprints, and he sees Frodo's footprints coming back down. So he knows Frodo's not up on the hill anymore, but he takes some time off from his pursuit of Frodo in what would seem to be a very urgent situation, still to sprint up the hill and sit on the seat of Amon Hen, because he knows, like, I'm probably not going to get a chance. This is it, right? This is the closest I'm going to get to this seat. I need to go there right now. So I agree. That's definitely an impulse of his. The other thing that I would connect with this, and this is a sort of a purely metaphorical, really, seeking of a high place to look around, and that's his looking into the Palantir in Helm's Deep on the way back home from Orthanc, right? He needs to know what's going on. He needs to know how things are sitting in order to make his decision. Now, I don't think that this is an unreasonable thing that Strider does, right? It does make a certain amount of sense that if you want to figure out where to go, you look around and get the lay of the land first, right? That makes all different kinds of sense. However, I do think sort of seeing that as a general tendency, there are some kind of conclusions that we can draw from that. You know, Strider, Fort Dauntless, well, we'll talk about it more when we get there about why he looks in the Palantir. I do think challenging Sauron is part of his point, but it's not my opinion that that's the main reason why he does it. I think he looks in the Palantir in order to see into the Palantir. And he challenges Sauron. He knows that in order to do that, he's going to have to challenge Sauron. And he decides, in the end, I think it's a good idea, right? I think it, rather than it being a bad thing for me to reveal myself to Sauron, I think under the circumstances, it would be a good thing and a net gain. So let's go ahead and do that. That's my assessment anyway of his decision process, though he's not totally explicit about that. Anyway, the one thing which seems to be most interesting sort of back to the whole sort of spirit of Philip's observation here, Aragorn is a looker before he leaps, right? In general. And I think that one of the things that I sometimes emphasize about Aragorn, and I remember especially when we were looking at, when reading the Two Towers in the Mythgard Academy class that we did on the Two Towers, which was one of the first ones we ever did. One of the things that I was really interested in there is looking at decision making, which I think is a major spotlight, especially in Book 3. And I was noting the faith under which Aragorn often functions. You know, he's often saying things like, let us take this stone that was set here as a sign, right? Let us take this as a sign and move forward, trusting that this is a good idea, right? That kind of faith is something that Aragorn shows on multiple occasions, right? That's a pattern of him in his decision making. But he is certainly not not wanting to just... He doesn't just move forward blindly, right? He does habitually want to see what's coming, right? Wants to know what's coming. So I think that it's just, it is an interesting little piece of evidence that we can put together with some other things in order to make a sort of a larger picture, to draw some larger conclusions about Aragorn as decision maker, which is going to be something that's going to be under the spotlight at various occasions, as I think, especially in volume three, in book three, rather. Valori, I like, he is acrophilic. I like that word. That's my word of the day now. No, Tamsin, it's not when in doubt, get high. That's similar, but not exactly the same as what we're talking about here. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, he's definitely not going to earn the blind leaper deed trifle. That's exactly what we see Aragorn not doing so often, right? And even again, if you think about it, thinking of Philip's reference to Carathras, it's not, of course, he doesn't go up Carathras because he's wanting to look around, right? But at the same time, he doesn't want to take a leap in the dark, right? Carathras is a danger, but it's a known danger. And that's the whole gist of his argument to Gandalf, right? Going into Moria is going into a much more complete unknown. So Arden Cray and I agree. There's something about, you know, his being a something about it's something somewhat kingly, right? You know, not wanting to, but I see, I don't think it's primarily about display. I mean, about being seen on the hilltop of, well, of course they might've been seen on Weathertop, but I think it's mostly about him seeing. So it's not about displaying himself for others to see. It's more about him having as much information as he can about what's happening around him in order for him to make his decision. That's not a bad thing, right? You know, that's, there's no argument that's bad. It's just an interesting point in light of some other things. Anyway, okay. Next, let's keep going. Second observation. We have two observations inspired by single words, which are great, right? I love single word observations. Okay, Matt was pointing out something about raiment. We talked briefly about the word raiment. It's an unusual word, right? And we talked about the sort of slightly more archaic tone that is struck there when he is seeing, you know, light shining through the form and raiment of the rider. Matt was doing some research and says, in the discussion of Glorfindel and his raiment, there was a sense that the word was being used differently. Looking through the times it is used, it appears to be associated with elf-made items, the clothing of Arwen and Glorfindel, the cloaks of the fellowship that are gifts from Galadriel. The other two moments are the raiment brought out of Theoden's hoard, the gifts of my fathers out of Gondor, and the cloak of Finduilus of Amroth that Faramir gives to Lady Eowyn in the Houses of Healing. Given the associations of named items in works like Beowulf, like his armor was made by Wayland Smith, there is a case for these items being either actual or, by reputation, attributed associations with elf make. That's really interesting. And I'm not sure. I don't know if... I don't know if I would go quite that far. Maybe it's as specific as that. Maybe there's this sense, you know, so do I think that Tolkien would sort of use that word under these peculiar circumstances? Meaning that. Do I think he might do that? Yeah, sure. I think it's a kind of thing that Tolkien would do. That I do think he would have been choosing deliberately when he used the word raiment in these particular cases. The main thing that I would say, and Matt, I don't know that, I don't think this is a disagreement as much as maybe I would kind of recontextualize it, or I'd approach the same thing that I think that you're seeing in a slightly, from a slightly different direction. I think I would say the word raiment is archaic. That, of course, doesn't make it illegal in Tolkien's vocabulary, but it makes it particular, right? And this is, again, something that I think that, this is something I think that Tolkien is often misunderstood about Tolkien. And you can hear this. There's even, I forget the number, somebody might look it up. There's some of his letters where he defends this. There's this one in particular, one of his published letters, where he goes on at great length about this, people complaining about the archaic terms that he uses. And he actually, goes into he gives one of Theoden's speeches and translates it into totally modern English, right? And kind of offers that as an alternative. And his argument basically is that, like, this is not an improvement, right? There's a reason for Theoden to speak the way that he does, right? Because he is a king, and because of the circumstances and everything, he would not talk like that. He would not talk like, you know, if you just put normal modern English into his mouth, he would no longer be him in his situation. It would be inappropriate. Anyway, the overall point, though, that I would get at there is that some people, I think, make the mistake of, you know, especially, you know, people who have not read much Tolkien or are reading Tolkien relatively sort of superficially, just have the impression that he's using random archaic words just for the heck of it, right? Like, he's just, you know, it's just a deliberately sort of stilted style choice, right, in which he's trying to separate himself from modern writers. And I do not believe that that is the case at all. He definitely uses those words deliberately in order to make a particular, to establish a particular effect, because he thinks that that word is better to use in that case than others. Yes, Simon, I agree. It is always a little bit people arguing with a philologist about his choice of appropriate terminology. Yeah, they kind of get what they deserve. People who do that, I agree. Anyway, coming back to Raymond here, right? Trifle, I agree. The verb arrayed would be interesting to look at there too, because that strikes me as similar, right? Arrayed is kind of a synonym for dressed, right? But it's different. It does not have the same effect. Just as raiment means clothing, but it is not the same word, right? What is the effect? Why does he go for a more archaic word there? It is possible, Matt, as you were suggesting, that he's associating this word in some way. It's a subset, right? That raiment, you know, in sort of Middle Earth terms, or like Middle Earth terms as translated into modern English, that means that there's, you know, is the implication that there is a is the implication there that in the original Westron, right, from which the text is being translated, they tend to, you know, like there's a specific noun, right, a synonym of clothing, which specifically means elf garments, right, elfin garments somehow, right, and that word Tolkien is choosing to translate into modern English as raiment, right? It's possible. I can absolutely see that happening. But I'm not quite sure. Again, the way that I would approach it, at least how I'd approach it initially, would be a little bit more, a little bit broader than that, maybe a little bit just less specific, less particular than that. One thing that all of these things have in common, right? The meeting with Glorfindel, maybe even less so, actually, the meeting of Glorfindel than many of the others, but seeing Arwen, right, and what Arwen is wearing, the cloaks of the Rohirrim, and the one who calls the Lothlorien cloaks raiment is Éomer, right, when they meet him. Strange too is your raiment, he says, right? So this is a stranger in a meeting unknown strangers situation being polite, as one tends to do. The raiment that's brought out of Théoden's hoard, right? That's a formal occasion. The presentation of the cloak of Finduilus to Lady Eowyn in the Houses of Healing is a formal occasion as well. I don't know that raiment necessarily means something like dress clothes, right? Sharon, I missed Cecilia's comment. I saw it flash by, but it disappeared before I could read it. Could you copy it maybe into Discord? I can't scroll back on my little screen here. I do think that Eowyn asks for her raiment, right? Eowyn asks for her raiment when she wants to leave the House of the Healing. Yeah, good. That too, like Éomer's usage of it, is it's not about formal garb necessarily, but it's it's in a polite, she's speaking formally to the master of the Houses of Healing, right? It's a formal request for her street clothes so she can check out of the hospital, right? So the way in which it's more polite, less casual, right? There seems to be either there's like an occasion associated with it, or the clothing itself in question is special, like Arwen's clothing, like the clothing brought out from Theoden's hoard, like the Cloak of Finduilus, right? Those are special garments, right? Elevated. See, I guess, Matt, in the end, what I'm wondering is the specificity of, is it about the clothing? Is it telling us something about the clothing, or is it telling us something about the atmosphere and the occasion in which the clothing is being discussed? See what I mean? That's what I think I'm leaning towards the other side of that, which would be able to encompass, for instance, Eowyn's calling for her raiment, and even Éomer. Éomer might possibly perceive that the cloaks that they're wearing, the elf cloaks that they're wearing, are strange or special in some way. So if the word raiment were to be associated with special clothes, he could conceivably be using it in that sense. But again, he could just as well be using it in the broader sense, just the broader sense of politeness. I'm speaking formally here, because I don't know you. I think of the comments that Tom Shippey has made about politeness in, you know, Anglo-Saxon context, right? You're always very polite when you meet strangers. You're always much more polite when, the stranger might whip out an axe and put it through your forehead, right? So you are polite under such circumstances. Politeness is a good way to avoid getting killed. And Éomer seems to be showing that species of politeness, I think, to Aragorn. Tony, raiment is used in the Silmarillion to describe the physical forms of the Ainur. I'm not really including that, mostly just because the register of the Silmarillion is different from the register of the Lord of the Rings. So, it's not necessarily I wouldn't necessarily include them in the same data set, I think. I'm not saying it's irrelevant. I'm just saying I don't think it is in that way not really a clean data point. If what we're trying to do is distinguish, sort of fine tune our ears to distinguish between the different registers and tones and usages within the Lord of the Rings, Silmarillion usages are kind of bad data points because the context, whole structural context, is very different. Good. Okay. Oh, but Tony, see, now that you got me thinking about that, I'm now thinking about it. Not from a tonal point of view, not from a question of formality versus casualness or anything like that. Matt points out that dressed, compared to arrayed, right, is used. So, Matt, does that mean dressed and arrayed are actually used the same number of times in The Lord of the Rings? Or roughly? What is it, 12 and 11, respectively? No. 11 and 12 dressed to arrayed, right? Isn't that what you said? Just checking in on that. Anyway, really interesting stuff there. Let's for a second bring it back to Glorfindel. Why here? Why does he use the word raiment here? Thinking, having thought a little more broadly for a second about the way in which the word raiment is, the occasions on which Tolkien chooses that word, right? Instead of saying clothing. Okay, arrayed 12 dressed too, that's what I thought. Interesting. Having thought about that, why here? Right, why with Glorfindel? And I think, actually, I would take the Glorfindel instance as one of the... I would argue it would be one of the stronger to say it's about the context more than it's about the actual garments, rather than being a tag for like a description of the, not a description, but a tag for like a, that it tells you something about the clothes. I mean, I don't doubt that Glorfindel's clothes are very nice. but he's not, you know, I don't know. I mean, he's outriding, right? Outriding into danger. Especially the way in this case in which we're talking about the white light shining through the form and arrayment of the rider. Form is also a slightly unusual word, right? Not something that's, it's not his body, right? Not his skin, not his, you know, it's his form, right? The form and arrayment of the rider. And that sentence has always had, it always sounds very reverential to me, right? Frodo, who is the one perceiving this, right? I would argue that he's, Frodo was clearly the author of that description, right? But anyway, the whole tone there suggests Frodo's own impression. His eyes are closing over, right? Yeah, Marianne, exactly. It's Frodo's point of view, and that's really important here, right? His eyes are you know, the shadows are coming between him and his friends, right? We got the description of that, right? And in this darkness, he sees the white light coming from Glorfindel, right? So having the living world, the world of daylight and friendship being dropped more and more into shadow and feeling himself more and more lost in darkness. Now, when he looks at Glorfindel, he sees this warmth, this radiance, right, coming from Glorfindel. And the words used to describe that are formal, even, you know, reverent in a sense, right? That's to me what sort of justifies the use of raiment. He could have said his clothes, right, or his clothing, but he doesn't. He uses the more formal word there. Not because it's a formal occasion, though they are being introduced. So I guess you could say that. But I think just in the context of that kind of reverence that Frodo feels as he's seeing the light shining through the form and raiment of Glorfindel, right? Trifle. Okay, yes, you can make the argument with the Ainur, right? The physical shape of the Ainur as being like raiment, you know, the bodies of the Ainur as being like raiment that they put on. Which so Frodo, just as Frodo is seeing past the physical to the spiritual essence of Glorfindel, so we have the spiritual essence of the Ainur and their physical form, which is but as their raiment. I'm not saying that there isn't a parallel to be made, that there isn't anything interesting to think about there. My objection was only stylistic again. When you're thinking about style and shifts in tone and register, the Silmarillion is in that sense a bad data point. Okay. Excellent. One more. This from another new person who hasn't posted before and who has been catching up with us. I always like to encourage the folks who are catching up because it's a huge job. This is from Net, who says, when talking about Glorfindel's introduction, I talked briefly about the implication of his being said to dwell in Rivendell. I said or implied that this distinguishes Glorfindel as being a part of Elrond's household or of being of some status within Rivendell. I think, she says, this also says something about choice. Glorfindel is not of the house of Elrond. He dwells there. To be described as of someone's household suggests a formal service arrangement. For instance, a member of a royal household renders service to the king or queen, even if they themselves are of a very high status. This service does not have to be hard and may be largely ceremonial, but it's a formal arrangement. For Glorfindel to dwell in Rivendell implies his high status and close connection with Elrond, but also suggests it's an informal arrangement of his choice. Glorfindel chooses to live in Rivendell for now, but he has not tied himself there. He is equally free to leave and maybe found a new elf haven if he wanted. For other comparisons within Tolkien, Galadriel dwelt in Doriath, in Of the Noldor and Beleriand in the Silmarillion. She is certainly of high status within Doriath, but is not tied there. Among the various different versions of their history, Galadriel and Celeborn leave Doriath before its fall, usually to create a new realm. I'm sure there are other examples as well. Perhaps this forms part of the distinction between elf lords and normal non-lordly elves. An elf lord can choose to attach him or herself to another for a time, even if it's an age or more, but ultimately it's their own choice to do so. I'm not sure what this says about non-lordly elves. Are elf servants gainfully employed, or do they serve for the love of it all at that moment? There must be someone doing the washing and cooking, etc. And of course, we meet some of the servants, upper servants, admittedly, but we meet some of the servants, the elf servants in the Elven King's Hall, right? Anyway, so I think this is an excellent distinction, and I would completely agree. He dwells in Rivendell, right? He dwells in the House of Elrond. He is like a permanent guest, right? But I agree. I think that Ned has absolutely nailed the implications of that, and that seems exactly right. And I agree that the parallel with Galadriel is an interesting one. Galadriel is welcome in Doriath, right? She is an honored guest. Clearly close with Melian, right? And obviously close with Celeborn. But she can leave anytime she wants, right? She does not serve the Thingol, right? She's not a part of his court in that same way. So Glorfindel, likewise, he's there because he wants to be there, right? But he doesn't owe allegiance. The other thing that I would recall is remember Gildor's introducing himself, right? He says, "My name is Gildor of the House of Finrod." He immediately announces his affiliation, right? What group he's in, right? Now, the fact that his lord is no longer in Middle-earth, right, having inconveniently perished for the time, doesn't change the fact that he identifies himself as being of the House of Finrod. But now, Fourth Dauntless asks, should it make a difference that Elrond isn't a king? Well, it's possible, but I don't think so. Galadriel's technically not, she's the lady of the Galadhrim, right? But she's not exactly an elf king, an elf lord in the same way that, like, Fingolfin was back in the old days, for instance. But Tony suggests that it's possible that Glorfindel sees himself and Elrond as peers. I agree. In fact, of course, if anything, it works the other way around, right? I mean, Glorfindel has a substantial amount of seniority over Elrond, and not only that, right? But he's a friend of the family, like a close friend of Grandma and Grandpa, right? As far as Elrond is concerned, he's like, "I used to babysit your dad," kind of family friend, right? So he is a family friend of an older generation who is still hanging around with the kids, right? Or has come back to live with the kids, right? There's definitely, and I agree, Glorfindel isn't of the royal line. Well, Elrond is. It's not just about seniority. And I'm not saying the last thing I would want to suggest is that there's some kind of like power struggle between Glorfindel and Elrond. Elrond is obviously the master of Rivendell, and Glorfindel isn't challenging that, right? He's living with him. He is not sworn to Elrond, right? At least not in any kind of formal way. I dwell there, right? The parallel I would make, you could say that this wasn't exactly the same, but I'm thinking about Elrond and Gil-galad, right, who were clearly very close. And yes, Gil-galad was the High King, so you could say, yes, Elrond was the servant. He was under Glorfindel, right? He was the subject of Glorfindel. Yes, but actually it still kind of strikes me as somewhat parallel, actually, right? Elrond lived with Gil-galad, and then of course he moves on and founds Rivendell later on. But anyway, yeah, Tony says this situation might also apply to Aragorn. Yeah, Aragorn also says he dwelt there, that he uses that same word. Now, of course, there's not the similar kind of thing. I mean, there's no question of identifying himself, right, that is saying, like, you know, there's no question of Elrond being like a vassal of Elrond, right, or a sworn servant, taking Elrond as his lord. They're in different political circles, right? But still, this seems to me, I think, as I said, a really excellent description of how things work there. Okay. All right. Yes, the dude abides in Imladris. That is exactly what we see there. Okay. Oh, but sorry, the final point, as for Elvish servants. Yeah, no, there are totally Elvish servants. I mean, this we see most clearly in The Hobbit, admittedly, because it's in The Hobbit that we get most contact with blue-collar elves, right? The barrel elves, the raftmen of the king, who are not men but elves, right? We definitely spend much more time among the working class of the elf world in The Hobbit than we do really anywhere in The Lord of the Rings. Anyway, yeah, I, you know, what is that exactly like? I don't know. Like, do they get wages? It's a little hard for me to imagine. You know, this gets into big, like, you know, I don't want to really get into, like, political economy and the elves, right? Though it's an interesting question. It's hard for me to imagine the elves living in a monetary economy, really, you know? I mean, like, what do you get, you know, like elf servants who get wages, and what do you have to give a cost of living increase every year for like 100,000 years, you know, like, do you save up for retirement as an elf? You know, like, how does that work? I just the only thing we have to go, the only firsthand examples we get of this kind of thing is the barrel elves. And you know, one thing that we can see about the barrel elves, they love their job, right? I mean, those barrel elves are having a heck of a time. I don't know. Trifle suggests that we have a sort of a medieval great chain of being idea going on here. And I think we do. I think that's true. I'm trying to imagine the life of an elvish servant, right? And all I keep coming back to is that every elvish servant we meet seems to be really happy, right? I mean, even think about the people who come and bring food to the hobbits in Woodhall, right? Among Gildor's people. Here's a jewel among hobbits, right? I don't think... Yeah, Tolkien does see value and honor in service, Tony. I agree. I don't know. I certainly don't want to get too distracted into talking about the economy of Middle-earth. I'm not saying that it isn't a topic that's interesting to discuss. I am just saying that I'm not a very good one to discuss it, because if there is one academic discipline that I am very largely ignorant about, it's economics. That was always like my Achilles heel of all academic disciplines. I could take an interest in almost every academic discipline, but I could never really take an interest in economics. Anyway, what is the master-servant relationship like? Is there really a master-servant relationship? Is that exactly how it works among the elves? I don't know. I tend not to think so. That it would be I don't think that what we have is just, someone was talking about, upstairs, downstairs, the elvish version. That's exactly what I would expect not to see, really. The kind of upstairs, downstairs difference that, that we get in, traditional, slightly older British society. I can't see that same kind of distinction going on. No, I wouldn't think there would be a barrel rollers union, unless you count them getting together, to sing barrel rolling songs and bake bannocks or something. Anyway, we could talk about this stuff for a long time. This is really kind of like a film sort of question, where when we're trying to do world building in the film project and kind of work out some of these things and think up some satisfying solutions that fit the evidence that we see in the text, it's really fun. But I don't think that's what we should be doing. I think I need to restrain myself from doing that here. So that's a big... this is a big question, and there's a lot of ways that we could talk about this, but I'm going to stop talking about this now. So one day we shall have this conversation for Thoughtless, but it is not this day. Totally agree. Okay. I have an idea. Let's talk about the next paragraph. Okay, so this is the one that I wanted to start talking about, but then I resisted it at the end of class last time. Glorfindel has just heard about the wound, and we just talked about the writing that he sees and that he suspects Aragorn doesn't see on the hilt of the weapon and everything. He searched the wound on Frodo's shoulder with his fingers, and his face grew graver, as if what he learned disquieted him. But Frodo felt the chill lessen in his side and arm. A little warmth crept down from his shoulder to his hand, and the pain grew easier. The dusk of evening seemed to grow lighter about him, as if a cloud had been withdrawn. He saw his friends' faces more clearly again, and a measure of new hope and strength returned. "You shall ride my horse," said Glorfindel. "I will shorten the stirrups up to the saddle skirts, and you must sit as tight as you can. But you need not fear. My horse will not let any rider fall that I command him to bear. His pace is light and smooth, and if danger presses too near, he will bear you away with a speed that even the black steeds of the enemy cannot rival." "No, he will not," said Frodo. "I shall not ride him if I am to be carried off to Rivendell or anywhere else, leaving my friends behind in danger." Glorfindel smiled. "I doubt very much," he said, "if your friends would be in danger if you were not with them. The pursuit would follow you and leave us in peace, I think. It is you, Frodo, and that which you bear, which brings us all into peril." Okay. Curita says, "searched the wound with his fingers makes me wince every time." I don't think that means he's actually like jabbing his fingers into Frodo's open wound. Searching a wound with one's hands, that's a very, I know the wound is closed, but he's touching it. Right, he's palpating it. This is a very people do this all the time. Search people's wounds. In fact, Corita, little spoiler, if that makes you cringe, wait until you get to the poor knight Sir Urre in Maori in the later section. The wounded knight who comes to court, because only like a special prophesied knight can heal him. His wounds will only be healed if his wounds are searched by the correct knight. So it's kind of like when Balin was trying, when they were all trying to draw the sword out of the scabbard and Sir Balin was able to do it. But only the correct knight, if he searches the wounds with his hands, will be able to heal the guy. So this guy's been going around from court to court, having everybody handle his wounds, and he's not died of sepsis yet. It's fun. It's a great scene. I love that scene actually. So him searching the wound, I think it's important that he's physically touching it, right? Because we get two things here. We get his physical touching of the wound, right? So he's coming into contact with Frodo and with Frodo's wound, and you can tell something is happening there, like at the wound site, something is happening physically, right? Because the warmth that moves through Frodo extends from the shoulder to his hand, right? He feels the chill lessen in his side and arm. The warmth seems to be coming through. So it is as if there is something that's being directly transmitted through his touch, right? So touch seems to be important. I don't think that he's searching the wound in a purely clinical sense, right? Sam, exactly. He's not just being like, does this hurt? How about this? Right? Yeah, no, that's not what he's doing. But I do think that his touching is important. He's doing something, right? Something is happening. But Zeph and I absolutely agree. The other thing that we see both things happening, both a physical impact and a spiritual impact. You could argue that all of it is a spiritual impact, even the warmth and the cold. The cold that we've been seeing seems to be a physical symptom that is associated with the domination of the will of, you know, the evil will of the Witch King, the evil power of the wound, right? That is infecting Frodo's shoulder. And his chest inside as well, right? But certainly the end of that, I absolutely agree, Zephon, is very clear, right? It's not just that he sees his friends' faces more clearly again. It is also that a measure of new hope and strength returned. He has received a little spiritual infusion from Glorfindel, right? There is definitely a spiritual impact. It's almost like the injected version of what Aragorn gives them by singing in the dell, right? But Tony, I too is very interested that Glorfindel does not sing or chant. I honestly sort of would expect him to under the circumstances. And that's interesting. Arden Crayon is wondering if there is some sense in which Glorfindel is drawing the power out from Frodo, even taking it into himself. We don't see any positive evidence of that, do we? Him experiencing Glorfindel experiencing pain? Yeah, not really sure. But as I say, I do think it's interesting that he doesn't sing. Tony is wondering if he's graduated beyond that. Maybe. Luke, I wonder if Luke says the evil can't abide the good, and so it withdraws slightly, right? Like the Black Riders withdrew from the bridge, right? When he came. And Arden Crayon, Glorfindel does grimace, but that's before, right? He grimaces when he's holding the weight. Does he grimace here? I don't think he's grimacing here. I think his grimace was when he took the knife. So the knife affected him. But his face is growing graver. That's all that we get, Tony. But that seems to reflect him gaining information. And Cecilia, I think it was Cecilia who just posted about that. Yeah, the word search is important, right? There. It doesn't only just describe his physically touching the wound, right? It also, he's gaining information, right? He's diagnosing here, he's treating, but he's also diagnosing here. Matt is arguing that Glorfindel is sending out rather than drawing in from the wound. I agree. Certainly, Matt, I agree with you. The light and darkness imagery that we get, right? The shadows are closing in around Frodo and the shadows pull back some, right? When Glorfindel comes, the warmth, he feels the warmth radiating down. He's not sucking it out. Like, it doesn't just recede from where it's, you know, it's like, well, his chest is a little better, though the arm and shoulder are still dead, right? No, the warmth comes down from the shoulder to the arm. It is like he's pushing something in instead of pulling something out. I agree. I agree. Arden Crayon, his face growing graver, is like the elf version of the doctor frowning at your test results. Exactly. Yeah, that does seem to be what it's like. Yeah. So. Yeah, no, again, several of you are thinking about, you know, again, darkness and light and shadow not being able to stand before the light. That is true, though, notice Glorfindel has already said he can't, you know, alas, the wounds, just when he's holding the knife, he's like, I don't got this, right? I can't heal the wound that's caused by this knife. Anyway, yeah, he is able to infuse some positive things into Frodo, but that seems to combat the effect of the wound. The shadows recede, right? He sees his friends' faces more clearly. The new measure of hope, and that, by the way, seems to be almost like two different ways to express the same thing. Right. It's significant, I think, that both when this shadow is described earlier on and when it's described as receding here is about his friends' faces. Right. It's not just that he can't see the trees and stuff and he can't see his own hand or anything like that. It's not just about the obscuring of his vision. It is about that, but it's not just that. Right. The thing that is commented on is that this shadow is coming between him and his friends. He is being isolated. He is being cut off from his spiritual support as well. Right. Yeah, he is buying Frodo time, Tony. And he is treating the symptoms, but can't solve the underlying problem for Thalos. Absolutely. It's going to come back, right? The shadows are going to return. The cold, the warmth isn't going to stay, right? He's not solving the problem. But what I said transfusion before, and I said it, rather lightly at the time, actually. But the more I think about that, the more apt, actually, I'm kind of thinking that metaphor is. It's like somebody who is losing a lot of blood, right? And you hook them up to an IV and you give them a few units, right, of blood to help replace some of the blood that they've missed. But, you know, the wound is, you're still working on the wound, right? The wound is still open. So they're still losing. I mean, it's going to help, right? It's going to keep them from bleeding out while you're still operating or before the wound can be properly treated. But it's not going to solve the problem, right? That does seem to be a spiritual version of that kind of blood transfusion seems to be what Glorfindel is doing here. And that's interesting, Archimago. And hey, I don't think I've seen you for a while. I don't remember saying your name in a while. One of my favorite names. I love obscure Edmund Spencer names. Doesn't get better than that. Archimago says the effect of Gorfindel's touch on Frodo seems to be secondary to the primary, presumably diagnostic intent. At least we don't see Gorfindel give Frodo regular laying on hands treatments. Yeah, you know, I wonder. I wonder if that's exactly, Marion. He's given Frodo a palliative. It's kind of like that. But yeah, if I agree with you, Archimago. What he's doing, the searching is the important thing. It's not treatment, right? Primarily, he's diagnosing, right? He's searching the wound and his face is growing grave as with what he's seeing there, right? But he's not, I agree, this is not like, you know, yeah, I'll come back, just like I'll come back and I'll give you a unit of blood every X number, you know, Q2 or whatever. That's not exactly what he's doing. Sorry, getting into the medical terminology. I've been living in a medical household for decades, so I do that sometimes. But it does seem to be at least a sort of positive side effect, and I'm sure one that he sort of knows as well. I do suspect that this kind of spiritual infusion is at least a secondary, if not a sort of a joint goal of his. I agree that his primary purpose seems diagnostic. Nevertheless, he's Emperor's is really honest. You want to do a Mythgard class on the Fairy Queen? What, because the Maori class isn't long enough? Is that why you want to see if you can nominate a book that'll take me a full year and a half to get through? Okay, yeah, that'd be good. Anyway, it'd be awesome. I mean, I love the Fairy Queen. I wrote my undergraduate thesis on the Fairy Queen. I mean, it's one of my Edmund Spencer's verse is so beautiful, so much fun. But anyway, that's not what we're talking about right now. Blue Wizard is asking if he could somehow be moving the shard. I'm not sure. I don't think so. He has said he doesn't have power over the wound. Like, you know, the wound is beyond his power to heal. I don't think he can affect the shard. And in fact, later on, we'll learn that. I don't think they're even aware that there's a shard there exactly yet, perhaps. Yeah, we'll get to that actually relatively soon now. So I don't think it's anything that particular. And I do think that if he were drawing it out, if he were sucking it towards him, then it would have, I would think it would be a different effect on Frodo, not that kind of injection of warmth and hope that he's feeling there. Let's get to the second paragraph there. You shall ride my horse. This is Glorfindel's reaction to his diagnostic effort, right? He's seen the knife, so he's like, I already know. Right, that we need to get this guy on an ambulance, right? And so that's what the horse is. You shall ride my horse. There's a possibility here that I'd never really considered before. Before this past time, this is my sort of new idea that just kind of came to me. And like most of my new ideas, I'm sure it will be one that half of you have had all along, right? And you're like, oh, he never thought of that before. That's what usually happens. But why does he put Frodo on Asphaloth? Why does he put Frodo on his horse? Obviously, I'm not questioning that his goal is to make sure that Frodo has the fastest transportation should the Ringwraiths catch up with him so that he can get away, right? But here's the other thing. You shall ride my horse. I will shorten the stirrups up to the saddle skirts, and you must sit as tight as you can. But you need not fear. My horse will not let any rider fall that I command him to bear. His pace is light and smooth, and if danger presses too near, he will bear you away at a speed that even the black steeds of the enemy cannot rival. I agree that his pace is light and smooth is important, right? For Thoughtless, I wonder, is that intended for Sam? Right? Is he trying to reassure Sam? Like, remember Sam getting all angry? Like, hey, you know, my master is sick and wounded. And he's like, hey, he's going to be better off here, right? He'll have a smoother ride here than he will anywhere else. Smoother than on Bill, no offense, Bill. And certainly better than walking. So, don't worry. JJ thinks that's just going to tick Sam off even more as he's going to leap to the defense of Bill. Maybe. But here's the phrase that really jumped out at me when I read this past time. If danger presses too near, he will bear you away at a speed that even the black steeds. Notice what he doesn't say here. He doesn't say, if danger presses too near, you can get him to take you away, right? No. It's the horse who's going to be making the call, right? Frodo shall be borne away by the horse at a speed that even the black steeds of the enemy cannot rival, parentheses, and which Frodo cannot stop, right? What if Frodo tries to escape? The horse won't let him escape, right? No rider will fall that he commands him to bear, right? That is, I wonder, after searching the wound, I think that he has exactly, Asphaloth is a self-driving vehicle, right? There you go. He has fulfilled the dreams of Silicon Valley right there. And Marianne, yes, he, Glorfindel, can communicate to Asphaloth, right? So Glorfindel is going to be in charge there. JJ, I think he may be worried that Frodo isn't going to maintain consciousness the whole way. Worse, though, I think what he's worried about is that Frodo might not be driving the bus the whole way. What if Frodo begins to succumb to the wound? What if, exactly, Mad Violinist, that what if Frodo is suborned? What if Frodo comes under the domination of the enemy? If he does, he could go and join. He could flee from them. They could be working against Frodo himself in trying to save the ring from the Black Riders. So, what's the best situation possible here? Get him on the back of the elf horse, who is going to take him willy-nilly, right? To use it in the old Middle English sense, will he, nil he, whether he wills or not, right? He will be taken across the ford. And if Glorfindel says the word, which of course he's going to do, one of my favorite Elvish phrases, right? Where he says, giddy up in Elvish, right? When he says the word, then the horse will take him, no matter what Frodo tries to do, right? The horse, it will then be Asphaloth's job to get the ring to Rivendell, and they won't have to go chasing after Frodo. Straitjacket and transportation all in one. Exactly, evil Dr. Cannon. How convenient, right? And Mad Violinist, you're right. In the end, it does require Glorfindel's command to overcome Frodo's reluctance, right? We will see that. We will see the struggle, the tipping point that Frodo's will is at, right? Exactly, Tony. Frodo is exactly like Mina Harker. That's exactly it. We'll think of questions about the ford. Hang on, everybody, right? Let's rein in the horse here. I did say giddy up, but I didn't mean you. Corinne says, back to my soapbox on how this whole story is about the heroism of horses and ponies. And Corita, I still think Tolkien is, throughout The Lord of the Rings, trying to make it up to the horses of England, right? For the hideous slaughter of ponies that happened throughout the Hobbit, right? All of those horses that were killed in the Hobbit, but they're getting justice done to them in the Lord of the Rings. It's their turn now. That never really occurred to me before. I mean, I'd always kind of just taken him, if danger presses too near, I never really noticed the emphasis there. If danger presses too near, you can escape on him, right? Is not what he says. What he says is, if danger presses too near, he will bear you away. He doesn't make any kind of threat here, right? He doesn't make a threat with that. But it's interestingly kind of packaged in. And to me, what really brings that home to me is the juxtaposition with the previous one. He's just diagnosed the wound, right? And his face is looking grave, right? I am certain that at this moment, Glorfindel knows what's at stake here. Glorfindel knows how close, Sam says, my master is sick and wounded, right? And Glorfindel has got to be like, you don't know the half of it, right? This is much worse. Now, Aragorn has suspected, right? He has suspected that the enemy thinks that Frodo has a wound that will subdue him to their will, right? But I think that Glorfindel has seen that a little bit more directly. And I think that Aragorn has deduced that, right? Glorfindel, I think, can, just as Frodo can perceive the light from Glorfindel shining through the form and raiment of Glorfindel, so I think Glorfindel can look at Frodo and be like, "Ooh, something right here," right? This is seriously not good, right? This is a patient in spiritually critical condition, and he knows what the outcome is going to be. Death is not what they have to fear, right? Frodo collapsing dead off the horse, not the worry. The worry is Frodo steering the horse to go ride back to the Black Riders, right? Gorfindel's telling Aragorn, according to JJ, dude, we have code pale. Code pale. Yeah, no, that's it. That's it. It's definitely a code pale. And what do you do for a cold? I mean, somebody calls a code pale, you just put the person on an elf horse, right? And send them riding off. Crownless, I agree. This it is really interesting to imagine what Gorfindel sees when he looks at Frodo. A faded form, I wonder. Yeah, a dark shadow pulsing in his shoulder. Yeah, I would think that he would have to be able to see the sort of spiritual battleground in Frodo's own flesh and in his own will, right? So I do think that his putting Gorfindel on the back of him putting Frodo on the back of his horse is a protective. It's protective in more than one sense, right? Frodo, I shall not ride him if I am to be carried off to Rivendell or anywhere else, leaving my friends behind in danger. And Carita, I agree with what you said before. This is really cute, right? The sort of good-hearted but fairly misguided sentiment of Frodo here is kind of cute, right? And Eternal Cow, by the way, that's a pretty good screen name. Eternal Cow, Frodo does kind of remind you of Sam here, right? With that sort of, it's like he not thinking it through, being saying something bold and devoted, but not clearly thought through, right? That is kind of Samish, isn't it? I don't know. Marianne is interested in how it is that the horse can prevent a rider from falling off, right? I don't know. Remember, Gandalf is going to say something similar about Shadowfax, and Shadowfax isn't wearing a saddle at all, so I don't think it can be something about elvish saddles in particular. I'm not sure how Asphaloth is meant to affect that. He will not let any. Oh, that was Cecilia's comment. Sorry, Marianne. Again, the one problem I have with our interface there is that I get your comments, but I only get them briefly, and then they disappear. So sometimes I'm like, oh, what? Someone was saying something, and I miss it, or I miss the name. I'm not really sure. You can tie people to saddles, Mudmore. I agree, but it doesn't look like he is. I don't know. Oakwing says the horse is a ring bearer. And of course Frodo is going to fall in the end. We'll get to that. We're not there yet. Gorfindel's smile is kind, right? I doubt very much if your friends would be in danger if you were not with them. And of course, the thing that is particularly poignant about Gorfindel's statement there is that it echoes Frodo's own sentiments from earlier on, right? Why he has, on several occasions, doubted whether it was a good idea, whether he was even justified whether he was even justified in bringing people with him, right? Because he was bringing them all into danger, right? So it's interesting that he is sort of gently being reminded of that. Luke is saying his uncle said that good horses, like rodeo-trained horses and stuff, would be able to do a really great job of keeping their riders on, so you wouldn't even have to hold on. I don't doubt the horse has some contribution to make to this. As before, this will not be the first time that I am ready to give way to explanations from the equestrians among us. I am not an equestrian, so I do not speak of what I know when I'm speaking about horse things. So horse people who are listening, you can tell me how much control Asphaloth might be expected to be able to have over whether or not somebody is falling off his back. The pursuit would follow you and leave us in peace, I think. It is you, Frodo, and that which you bear that brings us all in peril. That which you bear. Gorfindel probably knows about the Ring of Power. Probably. Gandalf has probably told Elrond. At least that seems to be how Tolkien constructs it after the fact in Unfinished Tales. Glorfindel would probably be in Elrond's confidence, so it seems possible. All I would say is I don't think that sentence is absolute proof that Glorfindel knows exactly what it is. I don't think there's absolute proof there. Evil Dr. Cannon there, it is you and that which you bear. Evil Dr. Cannon is suggesting that he's definitely thinking about the possibilities of Frodo wraithifying there. All Glorfindel would need to know in order to make that statement is that Frodo is bearing something important that the enemy wants badly. Right. He knows there's a thing. Right. Even Gildor figured that out. Right. Frodo is out there bearing a great burden without guidance. Right. And I'm pretty sure Gildor didn't know what it was exactly. Right. But he could tell there was something. Right. Frodo has something. The Black Riders are hunting for it. He doesn't know what he's doing. Right. Gildor could figure that out by meeting him. Right. Glorfindel knows Frodo's bearing something. He doesn't necessarily have to know exactly what it is. Singing Fox is asking if Glorfindel could see it. No. Singing Fox, I bet you, if Frodo is on the slopes of Mount Doom and met Glorfindel, if Glorfindel were hanging out on the slopes of Mount Doom as Frodo and Sam are trudging and crawling up the side of the mountain, I bet Glorfindel could see it then. I bet Glorfindel would see the Wheel of Fire, right? When it had gotten to that point, I suspect that its kind of spiritual signature, right, would be significantly plain for Glorfindel to perceive, but I doubt he can perceive it here. Tony suggests they would all know that Frodo owns a ring and they suspect it is the ring. Possibly. Trifle points out that, of course, the Great Eye totally misses it, to which I would respond, Great Eye ain't looking. That's the point. Had the Great Eye been scrutinizing carefully. This, by the way, is my least favorite part of the Peter Jackson Mount Doom sequence, which in general I like quite a lot. And the climb up Mount Doom I think is exceptionally well done. The part I hate, though, is when, like, the red light goes across and they're all like, oh, throw yourself down, as if that's going to help at that point, right? The whole point is that, you know, the light of Sauron's attention is not directed that way. I'm always like, seriously, why did we have to go there? JJ, I know Glorfindel hanging out on the slopes of Mount Doom, not lifting a finger to help, it would be, but presumably if he were there, he would help out. But if he were there, he'd, I think, probably be able to see the ring. Right. Okay. we're so not talking anymore about Mountain Doom right now. We still do have a little bit of a ways to go before we get there. Anyway, so I'm not necessarily arguing that Glorfindel doesn't know. He might. I would have no objection to that. I don't think there's any reason to really suspect that he doesn't know that Frodo has the Ring of Power. He might be one of the very few in the know about that. I'm just saying I don't think that him saying that which you bear... This is a mistake I think that we often make when people make elliptical comments like that, and we assume that it means that they know everything. It doesn't necessarily mean that they know everything. Sometimes they mean it quite literally, right? That which you bear. I'm not saying that which you bear, wink, wink, right? You and I know what it is, right? He literally doesn't know. And is saying, you're bearing something. Whatever it is, that's the thing that's bringing us into peril, right? I know that much, right? He might mean just that. Sometimes we take that to be knowing. The most extreme example of this that I can think of is Faramir, right? Faramir says that he suspected that Isildur took somewhat from the hand, of Sauron, right? And I'm like, yeah, okay, so like, what did he take from his hand, right? So then when Faramir acts all surprised, like Sam has spilled the beans, and I'm like, wait, doesn't he know? Didn't he say, right? But no, when Faramir says that, he doesn't know, right? He means literally what he says. Like, he took something from the hand of Sauron. I don't know what it was, right? And then he's all like, holy cow, the Ring of Rings? No way, right? We'll get there. But again, sometimes when people say something kind of cryptic and suggestive, they just mean it exactly what they said. Again, Gildor's not speaking in code. He's bearing a great burden without guidance. That's all I got, people. I figured out there was a burden, and I could easily tell he had no guidance. So, that's what I know. Again, this is not a wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of situation. Anyway, yeah, don't worry. We'll get to Faramir. Oh, and Faramir's practically around the corner. Okay. Let's see. Yeah. I think I'll live long enough to get to Mount Doom. I suspect so. let's all hope my health holds out and that we all make it. Oh, man. Anyway. Yeah. Let's hope we don't have to have a memorial service for those participants in the class who died of old age before we got to the end of our discussion here. Oh, man. Anyway. Okay. Let's keep going. Okay. Hey, let's do the next slide. What do you think? Okay. Haste. That's what it's all about. To that Frodo had no answer, and he was persuaded to mount Glorfindel's white horse. The pony was laden instead with a great part of the other's burdens, so that they now marched lighter, and for a time made good speed. But the hobbits began to find it hard to keep up with the swift, tireless feet of the elf. On he led them, into the mouth of darkness, and still on, under the deep, clouded night. There was neither star nor moon. Not until the gray of dawn did he allow them to halt. Pippin, Merry, and Sam were by that time nearly asleep on their stumbling legs, and even Strider seemed by the sag of his shoulders to be weary. Frodo sat upon the horse in a dark dream. They cast themselves down in the heather a few yards from the roadside and fell asleep immediately. They seemed hardly to have closed their eyes when Glorfindel, who had set himself to watch while they slept, awoke them again. The sun had now climbed far into the morning, and the clouds and mists of the night were gone. "Drink this," said Glorfindel to them, pouring for each in turn a little liquor from his silver-studded flask of leather. It was clear as spring water, and had no taste, and it did not feel either cool or warm in the mouth, but strength and vigor seemed to flow into all their limbs as they drank it. Eaten after that draught, the stale bread and dried fruit, which was now all that they had left, seemed to satisfy their hunger better than many a good breakfast in the Shire had done. Okay. Another mysterious beverage, Bjelvar, absolutely. Yeah. This seems to be... is this Miravor? Tony and Bruinir are asking. We're not told. We would have to compare... Blue Wizard, I was thinking of brandy as well. Right, quick, fetch the brandy! One thing we... So is this the same as... is this the same as the Miravor they're going to get in Karathras? Is this the cordial of Imladris? Maybe. That seems very likely, really, that it is. One thing we know is that it's not the same as whatever it was that the elves put in their bottles, in their water bottles, right? I don't think we made quite enough, laid quite enough emphasis on the fact that, that when they left the elves in Woodall, the elves filled all of their water bottles with booze. Right, like you won't need any water where you are, and we're just going to throw away all your water and replace it all with booze. Right, that's the plan. Okay, it's true, JJ. They were walking, not driving, so it was okay. I agree. I'm sorry, I missed the name again. I couldn't see whether it was Cecilia or Marianne. Was pointing out that Miravor is called fragrant, and this is apparently odorless or tasteless. I was also going to say that the Miravor warmed them, whereas this feels neither warm nor cool. That, though, you could say, well, being cold was their problem, and so in as much as it was healing and helping them, it was warming them up, right? That was what they needed at that point, when they were all risking freezing to death. I think that, you could still make the argument that it's different. We'll have to compare. It is fairly striking that it is, it has no taste. Well, it doesn't say it doesn't have a smell explicitly. Elvish Iocane powder. what you do not smell is, Aurelius Ambrosianus is thinking that there are probably several different types of craft Miravor from various elfish microbreweries. Yeah, I think that's the explanation I favor here. Yeah, yeah. Glorfindel has his own still where he makes his special Miravor, and his is colorless and tasteless. Yeah. Yeah, Glorfindel could very well be a home brewer, Tony. That seems quite likely. I think it is different, but it seems to be of the same sort of variety, right? Notice that one thing that's interesting to me here is how prevailingly spiritual the emphasis has been. That is, what they've needed is hope. They keep getting, whether it's Aragorn trying to encourage them, whether it's, you know, the fun that they have in the troll glade, whether it's, again, you know, the sort of the infusion from the hands of Glorfindel here. It's bringing hope. It's buoying their spirits. That's what they need. The effect of this liquor, it doesn't describe the effect on their spirits. It's almost entirely physical, right?
strength and vigor flows into their limbs as they drink it. It's not their hearts that are encouraged, right? It's their limbs that are strengthened by this liquor. And it has an effect on the food and how satisfying and sustaining the food was, right? Yeah, this is clearly a stimulant. So it's not like the booze that was put into their bottles, right? Which was colored as well, it was golden, right? Anyway, it's interesting to me that no description of their spirits or heart is mentioned here, which I think is, I don't know, it's just interesting to me. And possibly explaining why Glorfindel didn't give a dose to Frodo right away, which was a question I had often asked, right? Oh, if he had the magic, if he was carrying a big old, flask of potions of healing, right? Why didn't he give a sip to Frodo immediately, right? In part of the healing process. The answer, I suspect, is that that's not what he needs, right? It's those who are doing the walking that need this particular draft. Arden Crayon, that's a really good question. Arden Crayon says, why is Glorfindel even keeping the party together? Why is his response not just to take Frodo on the horse with him, like stay on his horse, pick up Frodo and ride off with him like Arwen does in the movie, right? It's an excellent question. I think there are two things that seem to me to be relevant here. One is he's not, Bloxman said it would be rude to split them up for one. Mad Violinist, you guys are thinking, yeah, and Marianne, several of you are saying similar kind of things. Trifle was saying the same thing, that taking Frodo away from his spiritual support here is perhaps contraindicated, as Mad Violinist says. Yeah, because Sam wouldn't allow it, says Blue Wizard. Also true. There are two ways that the two answers I would give to that. The first would be yes, like who knows what exactly the effect on Frodo would be. It could have a bad effect on Frodo, and given that Frodo is teetering on the brink, it would be tough, right? The second the second answer would be, he says that he thinks the Black Riders would leave the rest of them in peace and pursue Frodo, right? But he doesn't know. And I think that he would not feel right about abandoning Aragorn and the other three hobbits to be overtaken by the Black Riders, who are almost certainly coming along the road behind them, right? Yes, Aragorn could take the other three hobbits and hide in the woods, but still, I mean, they still have to get to Rivendell eventually, right? So, Guirendi's in the Twitch chat says Frodo isn't the only one that Glorfindel is helping here. Yeah, I don't think that Glorfindel, that decision to say, like, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, right? Saving Frodo is more important. If we've got to sacrifice the other three hobbits and even Aragorn in order to save Frodo, it'll be worth it. It has not come to the point where Glorfindel's gonna do that kind of calculus, right? And even if it were at that point, it is not obvious to me that Glorfindel would choose to sacrifice the others in order to try to save Frodo. That's not really how the good guys usually think in Tolkien. But and JJ, that is another good point. Glorfindel knows the Nine are likely to head to the Ford. It'll be easier to resist them as a group than just the two of them. Agreed. And it's, it's true that, I wonder if he perceives or suspects, he's heard their story. They've told the story, right? I wonder what Glorfindel thinks of the story of the attack under Weathertop, right? The Witch King and four of his riders, four of the other Nazgul, surrounded us, right? They were right there. They had us dead to rights in the Dell under Weathertop. They attacked, and they ran the heck away. And they have not bothered us since, right? That's the story they just heard. And remember, Aragorn was like, why they do not attack again? I cannot tell. I wonder if Glorfindel is wondering, right? As counterintuitive as it might seem on the surface, Glorfindel may just possibly be thinking, you know, having a bunch of these hobbits around with us might be handy. You know, he clearly is not sure that he can face the nine alone, all nine in one place, right? Three or four were clearly fine, right? But if it was all nine of them against him, and Frodo's not going to be any help, right, in his current state, he could be the opposite of help if it came to a conflict at this point. Is Glorfindel thinking it might be nice to have backup, right? These five who have already resisted five of the Nazgul, five on five, and they took him, right? Four hobbits plus Aragorn plus me, right? And my horse, right? Against all nine Black Riders. I like those odds better. It's possible that that's what Glorfindel was thinking. And JJ, I agree. Hobbits scare Nazgul. Confirmed. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Hobbits are like not Nazgul kryptonite, right? I mean, I think we're establishing that here clearly. And does Glorfindel perceive that? Does he suspect that? Maybe he does. The idea, and again, I will admit this is something another thing I haven't ever really thought about before, is Glorfindel really thinking of them not just as other charges to be protected, but potentially as backup, if push comes to shove, right? It's possible. It's possible. Tony says Glorfindel might be thinking along the same lines as Gandalf, trusting to their friendship rather than to great power or to great wisdom, right? Interesting. Matt says Glorfindel might also recognize the knives that the hobbits carry. Remember that it was glowing red, right, to the Nazgul. Maybe he sees it glowing red too, and he's like, actually, yes, we may have some actually seriously effective anti-Nazgul infantry here, right? They're short, but they pack a wallop. It sounds like I'm joking, right? But it could really actually be true. I think that that's entirely possible. I think it's entirely possible. Finn reminds us that he is also the one who had the vision, right? The foresight about the Witch King being killed not by the hands of a man, right? So yeah, Finn, is he doing that math there? Is he looking at it? He's like, huh, look at this. We've got four anti-Nazgul weapons in the hands of four non-men, right? This could really pan out, right? This really could. Ardent Crayon, that is also a thought I think that works in a couple different ways, right? Ardent Crayon has said, what about the possibility of using other hobbits as decoys? Now, we have precedent for this. In one of the advanced drafts, one of the later drafts of the Fellowship of the Ring, Tolkien had Gandalf using a hobbit. It was Odo. It was the last appearance of Odo before Odo Boffin vanished for good. Odo Bulger. Sorry, no, he was a Bulger, wasn't he? He wasn't a Boffin. He was a Bulger. Before Odo vanished for good, his last role in the story was Gandalf brought him from the Shire to serve as a decoy. He let it be known that he was carrying his hobbit friend Baggins here, right, on his horse with him to Rivendell so that the Black Riders would try to capture him. That idea is definitely out there, right? Could Glorfindel be thinking of that as well? I mean, and again, to me, that's something that cuts two different ways. On the one hand, they'd be useful to have along, right? Because, you know, you could do a scatter drill, like the Black Riders are coming. All four hobbits all run off in different directions, right? That gives, and I'll stay with Frodo. So that'll give everybody the best chance. But the other way that I say that observation cuts is that, again, thinking about them not being safe, right? If the Black Riders were to come across the other three hobbits with Aragorn, they know, you know, in a sense, yes, they know which one has the ring, or at least they know which one had the ring, right? Can they be sure, right? Would they, you know, kill or capture all three of the other hobbits just to be on the safe side? You know, they may well do. Okay. Was he Odo Bulger Boffin at one point? That seems quite possible, James. Because kind of a big, and he was Odo Took at least once, wasn't he? Or I'm thinking of Frodo Took, aren't I? Never mind. Anyway, whatever. I definitely think that Glorfindel wanting to keep the party together makes sense in a couple different ways here. And Zephon is right to remind us, as we already discussed, about the weariness of Aragorn. Aragorn's running on empty here, right? Aragorn's got nothing. So saying to Aragorn, "I'll take Frodo, you take care of the other hobbits," would still be asking a lot of him right now. He's at the end of his rope. Yes, Trifle, I agree. By Sauron's logic, Aragorn or Glorfindel should be taking the ring, especially when the current ring bearer is weak. Yeah, no question. Like, that's what they would do, right? If the situations were reverse, they'd seize the ring for themselves. They wouldn't, like, leave it in the hands of one of these weak, but disturbingly frightening little people. Good. Now, Iwendilian, the Nazgul didn't go for anybody in Bree. We talked about this before. The break into the Prancing Pony is almost certainly done by Bill Ferney and the Squint-Eyed Southerner, not by the Nazgul. It's not the Nazgul who break into the inn. It's the men who break into the men in their employ who break into the inn. And, of course, they would probably have just tried to kidnap all four of the hobbits, I think, certainly. Good. Okay. We should probably stop there. I only got through two slides. This is my second week of two slides in a row. Iwendilian, that's actually not... I mean, of course, it is true that a lot of people make that mistake because of the movie, right? Which clearly shows the Nazgul going into the inn. By the way, that scene is one of my little pet peeve scenes, actually, is the Nazgul coming in with Butterbur, like, cowering behind the bar, looking terrified, right? I hate that scene because, like, Butterbur is powerful, right? The Prancing Pony. The Nazgul can't go into the Prancing Pony. Are you kidding me? The Prancing Pony is like an anti-Nazgul fortress, and Butterbur is at the heart of that. Butterbur has some serious authority where the Nazgul are concerned, and he's ready. He's ready to show, if they show up at his inn again, right? He's going to show them off with a club, show them off the premises with a club, right? That, I think, is... that's Butterbur, right? One does not simply walk into the pony, right? Exactly. That's sort of the Nazgul version of that meme, right? Good. Excellent. Okay. So yeah, both Sam and, who was it? Down here. Finn. It is that way in the animated version as well. Yes, in fact, it's clearly one of the scenes that Peter Jackson is making a visual homage to from the earlier version, right? From the Bakshi, Fellowship of the Ring. Yeah, both of them make the same mistake. Anyhow, yeah, exactly, Blue Wizard. He's gonna take the price of those bolsters out of those Black Riders if they ever come back, right? Not to mention Bill Ferney and the Squint-Eyed Southerner. Though, of course, with the horse thieving, the price of bolsters becomes a little more moot. Anyhow, thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. We're going to shift to our field trip now. So I'm going to say goodbye to the folks on Twitter. I should be back next week. I'll be back. I should be back in plenty of time from Texmoot. I'll be coming back Sunday night. So I should be here. We should be fine for Tuesday. So I'll look forward to seeing you guys on Tuesday. And we'll continue as we inch closer and closer to the ford. We'll see. So anyway, so good night, Twitter folks. Thanks for joining us. And join us on Twitch, twitch.tv/signumu to join us for the rest of our discussion tonight. Thanks, bye. Thanks, everybody. Okay, there we go.
Good evening, everyone. This is Valori.
Hey there. Okay. All right.
So yeah, I totally forgot I have to reset my trait thing. So.
Oh my goodness, yeah, the trait trees are. It's a good thing I don't need to actually, shouldn't need to actually like do anything.
Well, it's weirder with the Bjorning because there's some things you can do as a man and some things you can do as a bear, and I right. have to make sure I have duplicates because the bars shift on it. Oh,
yes,
interesting. Yes. All right,
yeah,
that will have to do. But if I mess up, then please forgive me for all the people who I can't protect this week.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I'll still get. I can still get my. My links. So there's that at least.
That's cool.
Okay. All right. So we're going to head back to Trollshaws. We're going to continue our examination of the Trollshaws. Can we get into Delosad without the quest? Do we need the quest or can we wander around in there?
I don't actually know.
Let's go try it out.
Let's try it and see.
Let's go explore.
So, anything we can take a look at the outside.
Yeah. Yeah. We ended... like basically in the open air alcove last time is where we finished uh-huh. up. So we looked around a little bit enough to clearly establish that this is another Rudauran place.
of course.
All of it.
Of course
still.
It's Rudauran.
Okay. Pontine says we can go there whenever. So good. If we can get in, then I'd like to go inside and see what we can see on the inside there.
All righty. Doing the usual thing, Oscar Earth, and taking a ride up.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. It's like no, the other option is yeah. going to Rivendell and going to Eckert Canalit, but...
Can't see anything. Sorry. I'm having trouble with my obstructed view here. Okay. People's laundry blocking me. I was going to fall off the bridge.
It's nighttime. Take it in.
Exactly. I know, people. Come on. You're going to get dew all over your laundry. Is that what you want?
It's winter, so it'd be freeze dried at this rate.
Exactly. Okay.
That's one of those things my kids are always asking about when they see it on television. It's like, what about people who dry things outside? Don't they have allergies? What's wrong?
Yes. Oh, yeah, wait, we are on Arkenstone, right? Aren't we on Arkenstone tonight?
Which one?
Are we on Arkenstone? Is that where we are?
Yes. Okay. This is Arkenstone, yes.
That's what I thought.
So I have no idea where my steps
are. All right. Wow. I still have my player music sound turned way up, which is why we're getting serenaded here at the Stable Master. I was doing Ales and Tales last night and
oh, fun.
So I had the music turned way up so we could hear the music over the stream.
That's fun. Yeah, no, I don't think I've heard in-game music for years. I think I always have it turned off when we do this and when I do Girls of Mythgard, so I don't
Yeah,
know
I
what.
Usually turn it down just so that I can, yeah, so that I'm not suddenly assaulted with sound as I'm riding through, like by the Prancing Pony or something. But,
yeah.
All right.
Listen to Alan Parsons' project in the background. I'm all good.
All right. Okay. Okay, so we can go in, but we can't enter any door. That's fine.
Uh-huh.
That's fine. We can live with that.
Yeah. We can look around, break a couple of ankles, you know.
Right, exactly. All right, let us head off then, because it's going to take a little bit to get there now. We're getting further and further afield here.
Keep forgetting I have the super speedy mount on. I think I gotta dismount and turn it back on. There we go.
Yeah. Okay.
Did you have a nice holiday then?
Yeah, I did have a nice holiday. It was relatively quiet. Didn't really go anywhere for Christmas this year. We stayed home.
Yeah.
My wife makes up the call schedule for her work, so she put herself on Christmas this year, you know, just to like show that she's not playing favorites on the schedule. She was paying her dues this year, so we were home.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, my husband sings at our church, so you know, it's definitely one of those winter solstice, I'll see you again on New Year's kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
We did it nice and quiet at home. It was really fun.
Good.
Couldn't get anyone to watch my favorite Christmas movies, which are It's a Wonderful Life and Shop Around the Corner, but where they're still not into black and white things where people talk a lot.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm really looking forward to Texmoot this weekend. That is one of the things that it's been cool. We've been looking forward to it for so long. It's one of those things that has kind of crept up on me, you know, like just, you know, this week I've been like, wow, holy cow. That's just in a couple of days. I'm, you know, catching a plane in 2 days, you know, been really fun to anticipate.
Well, hope the weather holds for you.
Yeah. I think we should be, I think we should be okay, even if we get wretched weather. But yeah, I'm hoping that we don't end up with any huge travel delays on account of snow or anything. But haven't seen any concerns about that up here, and I'm trusting that we won't have any problems of that sort down in, you know, Dallas Fort Worth, where I'm flying into. But
this year it seems more likely there's going to be snow in Texas.
I know exactly, right? Given what we've been seeing. You know, we were just talking about before.
We just got clobbered with 10 inches where I am on the East Coast. 10 inches. And I'm supposed to be going to Williamsburg on Friday for MarsCon.
Uh-huh.
And they're saying more snow Thursday and more possibly again on Sunday. So
we've gotten rain this year. Oh. We've gotten so much rain in the month of December. And a bunch of ice. My kids have still had several snow days because we've had several really dangerous icy mornings.
Ice days are the worst days. It's like all the snow day, none of the fun attached. Yeah, this one was fun. You know, the kids, we finally got the kids to shovel out the driveway for themselves this year. It was amazing.
Oh, there you go.
We just had to pay, you know, what we would pay anybody else to do it for us.
Don't you hate it when you've got to end up paying your own kids and you're like, man, this did not happen when I was a kid.
Yeah. Well, so then just playing in the snow and making cookies. And I think we binged watched 2 whole seasons of The Good Place and my head hurts now, but
that's cool.
Fun times though. Fun times.
Yeah. We've had some cold weather, but it never coincides with it has never really coincided with the precipitation up here in New Hampshire so far this year.
Weird.
Yeah, it's been a strange year.
Yeah, I think we're supposed to get hammered again in February on top of that, too. See, February is usually our nasty month, so it's where we're getting it. But yeah, for all the people laughing up north for, like, oh my gosh, 10 inches, like, this is Virginia where we don't get that nice powder that packs down and you can drive on top of it. This is basically like a road covered in soap suds.
Yeah. No, and it's, and I understand. I mean, you know, from having lived down there. In fact, it was funny. I was just reflecting on that, I was driving through my took my family up skiing to the very northern part of Vermont. We were right near. In fact, we were so close to the northern border of Vermont that at one point I was dropping them off at the ski slope, and we all get this text on our phones saying, "Welcome to Canada. Your Verizon service will work." You know, just I'm like, "Wait a second, we're not in Canada," but I guess apparently
nice we must try, have caught Verizon
service from a Canadian cell tower. Is how close we were.
That's close.
But anyway, so we're way up in the north of Vermont. And as we were driving home, you know, sort of through the country, and we're in these tiny little Vermont towns, way up in the north of the state. And in one of the towns, we drove past this big barn in this whole yard with like all of their snow plows, right? For the town. There could not have been like 1,000 people who lived in that town, right? But I'm looking at this lot, right? And I'm like, you know, I bet you this little town up here in northern Vermont has more snow plows than the entire city of Atlanta. Basically, you know, I would not be at all surprised to discover that. You know, I get it. It's just different.
That's crazy. Yeah, no, I was trying to describe to somebody up in Canada right now. It's like, what's it like driving on Virginia snow? And they were playing Lotro too. I think it was one of the girls of Mythgard. And I'm like, imagine trying going up that switchback mountain in Misty Mountains right. on a war steed.
Right.
That kind of drift, you know, that little, you know, horsey rear end drift. Yeah. Fantailing, that is Virginia snow driving right there. It is not pretty. And I have this gigantic van. Vandolph the White, remember.
Oh, wow. I have you floating in midair, actually.
Oh, am I Harry Pottering?
Yes, you're totally Harry Pottering right now. Anyway, okay, so here's the Ford, by the way. So we'll spend a little bit more time here, of course, when we actually get to the Ford in the text, but I figured we might as well.
For those of you taking bets earlier, I don't know if this counts. You'll have to debate that.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if this counts as making it to the Ford. But I wanted to come over here so that we could go down river, actually.
Be prepared to be dismounted by deep areas.
Yeah, we're going to get there, but then
Can we get there through this area, or do we have to go on,
I think we can get
down the switchback past Echo Candleth. Be prepared to suddenly die in an area of river because we're not supposed to be in this part, but let's try it.
I think I've swum down from here before. I think we're okay.
Okay, let's see what happens.
Right, here's where the area where at the Blooming Fens with all the bog lurkers.
Oh, yeah, they're all coming out to play now.
Uh-huh. Okay, so we've got some little swampy areas down here.
Uh-huh. Yep, I'm a little tied up here.
Looking at the terrain. Okay. Are you getting attacked?
Yep, just a bit.
You're getting a bit attacked. Okay, yeah,
just
you might,
a bit.
You
not to your notice.
You might want to stick to the river.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, if you're at lower levels, just stay in the middle of the stream is probably the safest thing.
I was defending lowlies.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Let's see. Do we run out of terrain up here? I think we
not can. Sure.
Let's see. We were exploring. I just wanted to see if there was anything else over here on this bank. Because I know there are a few things. Yeah, we can get through here. There are a few things kind of scattered around that I wanted to make sure we didn't miss.
Someone's still running around being wrapped up by a vine.
Oh, man. Oh, yeah. Yeah. There you go.
You think that would have dispersed by now.
Bringing their vine with them. Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. So where are we? How close are we to? Oh, we're getting down there. Okay. I'll keep going over here. Because we've had no evidence. Of course, my interest here is not just looking for like current settlements and things really relevant to the game, but really any sort of historical evidence as well. Like, is there any evidence that, because we had Delosat is clearly a Rudaran place.
Mm-hmm.
But we know we are way at the, aha, here's one place of interest.
Oh, yeah.
This little cabin here. Now, of course, we know this is important in the epic quest line. You know, won't spoil it for people who haven't done that part of the epic quest line because we don't have to talk about it. But we do know that this cabin is of comparatively recent make.
Yes.
That is, you know, within the third age. So it's like less than 3,000 years old, this cabin. Really significantly so, because we also know it's after the fall of Arnor. So it is post, certainly post the ancient Rudauran time, even post even after the whole Arnorian civil wars were done. But one of the things that interests me about this here, without giving anything away, we know that this cabin was built in order to be isolated, right? So that it, I mean, it was meant to be in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Which, you know, tells us some kind of interesting things about this area, that it is seen as, you know, particularly, specifically,
desolate.
Yeah. Down here, as we're heading down towards Eregion, which is mostly desolate, and working farther away, the only thing that we get is that old outpost, you know, which we're closer and closer to. Yeah, we are in fact directly across from that now. But it's way up on the heights over there.
Oh,
in fact, hey, look, there we get the cool view of the ruins from below. Nice. Yeah. But again, notice you don't have a wall, you have a colonnade. Now, who would need to build a wall on top of that sheer cliff? But still, you know, we see, as we've seen before, the evidence that the Rudauran, many of the Rudauran structures out here in the, you know, hinterlands of the old Rudauran kingdom are, you know, mostly for not decoration, but for pleasure rather than for defense. These are not fortresses
leisure
that we're seeing. Yes,
they're leisure palaces.
Leisure palaces, exactly.
Delosan, nice
though,
view.
Yeah, Delosan, though, I'm not so sure about. So that's it right up here. Okay, I think my lynx is back there killing things as we go along. So yeah, we saw very clearly that, obviously it's Rudauran from the very beginning, right? You can clearly see the very prominent crowns right there. Notice how we have the multiple sort of colonnade structure there, which was just like the one across the river there, right?
It's almost like they're parts of the same whole, like...
Yeah.
Like they're meant to sort of counterpoint each other.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Beldurnik, on the other side of the river, we saw that ruin. We saw the ruin where the Gowardine are, where the wolf folks, right? That's the only ruin that we found down over here. We saw there's you know, Ekad Kendaleth up there, and there are a few other random gazebos and stuff through there. but this was a more major one that we went into, and it was really interesting. But it was definitely Rudauran, and more fortress-like, certainly, than many of these others. But here, going back to Delosan, so we see the way that it corresponds, right? The way that it corresponds with the Ekad Kendaleth up above on the hill there. My question, I'm trying to figure out, what was the purpose of this, do you think?
There's some drop masonry here indicating there's pieces of it that fell off from one or the other.
From up above, presumably, right?
Now, possibly.
It's dark in here. You know, the thing closes in. You know, the light closes in. We're going through this...
It looks pretty when you turn around, though.
Really, in both directions.
At the top of the stairs, it's very beautiful if you look back through the purple.
Yeah, we've got all these hanging growths and things. They're really nice.
It's not sinister, just dark.
Right, because we're under, you know, we're in a tunnel, right? So that's fine. Uh-huh. My question when I was looking around in here, I was like, is this... meant to be? Like, is this like tomb or secret garden? Like, that's what I was kind of, because this has a kind of secret garden effect to it, right?
Yeah, you know, like a grotto, a big old grotto with an open plan here.
Yeah, and I think the court. Yeah. It is open to the sky, right?
Yeah, it looks like it was a cave-in, but you definitely get the feeling that this was put here because of the cave-in that had happened earlier and not afterwards.
Right, exactly. There's like a skylight. So there is a ceiling, but it's got a skylight in it.
Yeah, and because we know the other one's a leisure palace, this might have been some sort of grotto retreat. You know, some place to go when it was hot in the summer.
Right. It would certainly have been cooler in here. And yeah, this looks... this looks very, and yes, it is Ekhad Kandaweth up on the other side of the river there, Crystal Eowyn. That's exactly it. sorry to the people who are still carrying vines around. Druid's Fire says that's getting fixed in the next patch. I think it's just a bug. Sorry about that. Anyway,
you go smoke your pipe while the vines are on you. It's all cool.
Yeah. And there's a passage? Is this yeah, so the ceiling comes down lower over here.
It's a step entrance, I believe.
Yeah, where is this? This is
It's back- like we're near the top of the cliff up here.
Yeah, it's interesting. And then the whole way around it's just one round cave.
Right? Yep. Big red rotunda.
Yeah, kind of and you've got the lower ceilings through here because you've got the walkway up above that you can get to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, two stories. That's pretty impressive in this biggest space.
Yeah. Okay, so you come into the secret garden, then you got to go up the steps.
Uh-huh.
So we're now closer to where the ceiling comes down up here.
Yeah.
And we've
built it turns into natural rock up there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We see this arched facade all the way around, and a path goes all the way around the top. So on both levels, you have this, you know, sort of cloister effect, right?
Yeah. It's a cheat for a vaulted ceiling.
Yeah, I'm getting a little...
And then we get iron bars
side chapel here.
Yeah, there's iron bars on it. Are those bars recent? Yeah. Are those recent?
They've got hammers.
Yeah.
Look at the hammers.
They're dwarf made.
They do look dwarf made. And then look at the detail work.
Mm-hmm. The Celtic knot work. You can see it a little better in the light out here.
Yeah. Yeah. And those hammers are very dwarf hammers.
So this was a recent addition and possibly not put in by Rudar. Because we do know that later that the elves have claimed this area. So.
Yes. So was this the Rudaurans ordering a set of dwarf made gates? Which is conceivable.
What would you keep in here if this is a leisure palace and you have iron bars? Is this like an animal stable?
It's a little weird. I don't know.
This is where you keep the chihuahuas. I don't know.
Bars would have to be a little closer together.
The chihuahuas. All right, big old wolfhounds.
Yeah. Right.
More bars
same?
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Notice how the hammers are only on the back side.
Yeah, it's almost like this is the front and the other side is the back.
Yeah, which is weird. The front is from the inside. Or it's almost like on the backside here, the people who made the gates put their like trademark up above the door, but they
leave.
Yeah,
it's like the signature on the back of the painting.
Exactly. Yeah. But they leave the plate empty up front so that, you know, the owner can put his name there, you know,
or the function of the room
or something. Right. Exactly.
It's like, so you don't confuse the rabbit pen with the dog pen.
Yeah. No one would want that. Yeah.
But yeah, those are pretty big gates, pretty big bars. So
they really
definitely
are.
Bigger than a chihuahua.
Yeah.
How big? How big is the question? And What, to what end?
What is this, a quiff?
I don't know. Yeah, I think it's... Oh, yeah, yeah. This, I've broken my leg on this one before.
Oh, this is... Yes, yes. This looks a little short-sighted.
That's near the entrance to the stairs that go down.
Oh, right, this is where
might have been.
Right, this is where they come in.
There might have been stairs here that made up some material that rotted away.
All right, well, so now we have like a bridge effect here.
Uh-huh.
And of course, we know all too well that elves don't use
guardrails.
Yeah, so exactly. As I know to my cost from my experience in Rivendell.
Yeah. There's no OSHA for elves.
Yeah, so. Oh, look, the
dwarf. Oh, see, this one, the hammer's on front.
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing. Are they on both sides, I wonder?
It's the same kind of room. It's not any different.
Yeah.
I think it's down to installation, probably.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe whoever installed it installed the other ones wrong.
Yeah, it's like my IKEA bookcase that has the plywood sticking out on one end of the shelves and the other ones have the laminate on the right side.
Yeah, made that mistake with one of my son's birthday or Christmas presents this year. We installed it, one of the parts backwards, and he was like, it's okay, I can live with that. Yeah. We were focusing on function and didn't notice that the label was just on the absolute wrong side. It's fixable, but we decided not to bother. Maybe that was the same situation here. Yeah.
Mm. So the dwarves shipped all the parts in a flat box, and the elves had to put it together. And there's some point going, you idiot, you put it on backwards.
Yeah, that's it. I think that's clearly the best explanation of this. The dwarves didn't install it themselves, so they would have been.
No, they bought a Krumvar from the dwarven smiths.
Yeah. These are wooden doors. These doors are unusual. Have you seen doors quite like this? I don't remember this kind of handle.
I don't remember either.
Hinge decorations. It's unusual just to have wooden doors at all. Usually they look like they're made of, bronze or something like that.
I think we're used to seeing portcullis and things like these.
And that too, yeah, exactly. Oops, I can't get in. It won't let me in without the corresponding quest.
I think that's quest related to the epic quest.
So I can't see.
It's an amazing quest, by the way. I know.
I do love that quest. Yeah.
I want to do that quest line again now.
Yeah.
So whoa, who opened it?
Hey.
Someone else got the quest.
Still not going to.
Someone else got.
But at least I can peek. Yeah. Hang on. All right, we can peek.
There is two doors and nothing else.
Those are doorways, right?
Yeah, two doorways.
Doorways, not niches. Yeah. Okay. Oh. Oh, and the door just slammed in my face. That was so cold.
Took my nose off. Yeah.
Oh, well. Okay. All right. Well, a tantalizing glimpse inside of Delisad. So.
Just a lot of bars.
Tamsin, I wonder if it lets you in. It still lets you in after you've completed the quest, but if you have never gotten that quest yet, it won't let you in. I would not be surprised.
So maybe we can go in on a later alt or something like that who's already done the quest.
Yeah. Yeah, I suspect so. Because I seem to remember
going back. Keep in mind next time we're on Landreval.
That's true, though Narnian won't have been in, but... Yeah, Narnian who has... I'm not sure if any of Narnian's manifestations have ever completed a quest.
I have similar problems with my alts on these other servers.
Catriona, I don't think I'm going to be able to get Narnian up that high. That seems unlikely. Although, I am going to have to do some actual XP work with Narnian on Honor, which we're looking to do.
I have a
kind of idea that when we arrive at Rivendell, it would be fun to celebrate the arrival at Rivendell by doing like a lobby run, right? Like a chicken run where we take like level 5 Narnian and try to get me all the way to Rivendell without dying.
With level 13 Valori.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm down with that.
Yeah, that could be a fun little project.
Ride or die.
Yeah, exactly.
Preferably not the latter.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Let's see. It's getting late. I was going to say we could ride up in the hills, but maybe we'll save the hills in Giant Valley for next time. But conclusions here. So what do we think? Probably an unusual, like a retreat center is the likeliest usage of this, like original usage, Rudauran usage of this. I mean, it's
not
so,
later Elven usage.
Exactly. I think that the tunnel on the way in, it has a kind of funerary aspect to it, and the way that it gets darker, not just because the sunlight disappears, but it seems like we get that like almost dread induced shadow, right, as we approach in, like you do in different parts of Angmar. Yeah, I think that gave me the impression when I first visited here, like maybe this was an old crypt or burying ground or some kind of arcane, site for arcane rituals or something like that. But I don't see any reason to suspect, just from looking at the architecture in here, that this had any kind of, black magic or even mortuary purposes, really. It seems most now it's hard because on the one hand I want to say I think I am perhaps influenced by the current state of things, like when we come in here and we've got all these lovely flowers and nice trees, it makes it look, and you know, the floating, you know, dandelion puffs right as they're going by, it looks extremely peaceful. But that could all be recent, right? This has been a ruin for, you know, more than 1,000 years. So all that stuff could have just grown up. And we know that the elves have been here since then, right? So
and they can restore light to a place that was once grim and dark.
Indeed, they could even have knocked the hole in the roof, conceivably, right? So that grass and trees could return to this place. Indeed, that leads me to notice these trees are all really young trees. There was no way these trees... Maybe those ones are a little taller.
Well, they don't get a lot of light either.
They don't get a lot of light. But they don't look... These are not huge, ancient trees, right? I don't see any reason to
believe... These are like the trees that spring up in my flower beds.
Exactly. I don't see any reason to think that any one of these trees has been here for 1,000 years, honestly.
Okay.
So, maybe it was the elves that knocked the hole in the roof. Maybe the elves knocked the hole in the roof, let the sunlight in so that grass, flowers, and trees could grow in the middle of this, which would mean that originally, and if we go closer to the edges, we can see perhaps, still flowers over here, at least certainly if we go underneath, rock and dirt, right, is the floor over here. So if this just a rough stone floor in the central quarters, if we imagine it being dark, right?
It's more like a stronghold than...
Yes, like it would be a secret stronghold. Still strangely designed, you know.
Says I'm seeing that area with the no stairs is like a place where you'd put pots of boiling oil or molten lead or something like that.
I don't know. It's weird, though, because, again, it's all... cloistery, right? It's just like places to stroll, it looks like, you know, the admittedly
or store things
or just conceivably, right? But yeah, the whole you know, cloister underneath and cloister up above, and yes, we do get the strange dwarf made gates, you know, with the iron bars, which look like they could be, they don't look like cells, they're a little spacious and outdoor-y for cells, but still, you know, they're this just looks like mostly open wandering territory rather than what you would expect to see out of cells. Though I guess we've seen spacious cells like the cells in Bree with their, you know, 18-foot cathedral ceilings and stuff. so, you know, who knows? Jake Wees is suggesting maybe the central space could be a mustering yard. Yeah, it could be a private gathering spot. Like a secret gathering spot. Though what you would be mustering for, I mean, you're way the heck. I mean, just thinking map wise, right? I mean, this has got to be the point furthest away from the center of Rudauran power.
Yeah, this is more
in
of
the
a last
entire.
resort than a sudden call to arms.
Yeah, certainly.
This is a
Certainly.
bunker. This is a bunker. It's
A
not a
bunker.
stronghold.
Yeah. Maybe this is like we will retreat into the distant south, and you know, like if worse comes to the worst, we can retreat into the distant south and you know, and
It's
pull
easy to
up
miss
here.
this place from the outside if you don't know where to find it.
It is. It is. I mean, of course, the outside door a little more conspicuous than you would expect if it were a, you know, a panic room. But you know, I think it seems conceivable, especially if you're not expecting somebody to come scouring this part of the country because it's so far out of the way, right?
Well, the hidden stronghold, they lost it because it was too well hidden.
Yeah. Luke is wondering if this could have been a stronghold of or a secret refuge of rebel Rudarans who were holding to the old non-evil ways as the Rudaran kingdom went, you know, under the influence of Angmar. Possibly.
Like all the vassals in the summer palaces were suddenly like, okay, we're not into this, and
Right,
they just sort of
exactly. Yeah, we th
ran
you know the
away.
things are getting
So
all
not the
dark and
soldiers.
gloomy. Yeah, exactly. Let's
Yeah.
possibly. I would expect if it were a hidden retreat, I would still expect there is not a gate or a door, right? I
Nope.
mean, like this was not built to be defended. There's a passage in, it's secret, kind of secret, and it's you know, you only have the one entrance, so that's kind of defensible, but there are no gates, doors, or walls anywhere, you know, blocking the entry. So doesn't really look like a fortress, but I could see
Yeah.
retreat.
But I keep coming back to the comment you made about the elves knocking the holes in the ceiling,
Right.
and that's a very sort of Tom Bombadil solution too. Just leave everything to the sun.
Right. It is a kind of Tom Bombadil solution. Now, Trifle is suspecting that Liardin would not put it to the use that he did if it was evil, you know, if it had like an evil tradition.
That's a little spoilery, but it's a very good point.
It's
Very,
possible. It's
yeah.
possible. I don't know. Maybe. Maybe. Beldarnik is suggesting that possibly entrance doors or gates were destroyed in the past, which is always conceivable, but I mean, these pillars clearly never had a gate in between them. I don't see any evidence of any.
Yeah, this looks like a place that was never meant to be defended.
Yeah, really. I think it's got
Like,
pillars in there, but no. Yeah, I don't see any evidence that there was ever any gate.
no iron bracers. All the rock here is natural and just.
Yeah. It's, I mean, these pillars and arches, these are just decorative.
I mean, look at this. This is pretty with the dawn light coming in. From this side, it almost looks like wisteria instead
Ooh.
of ivy.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. That is nice with the light from outside. Is it dawn? Yeah, it is. Nice.
Yeah, it's done.
Nice. Yeah.
Just peaceful.
Yeah, it does look nice. Retreat? Maybe the home of a Rudaran monastic order. Ah, I like it. No evidence that there was ever any such thing. But that kind of thing I could see, you know? But yeah, it doesn't seem like, you know, evil rites were once held here. It doesn't seem like I don't see any tombs or evidence of tombs. Yeah. But, so yeah. Retreat center. You know, you could probably book your bar mitzvahs here, maybe. I don't know. You know, it's. I could see something like that. You know,
Wedding
the
hall,
wedding hall.
girls' nights.
Yeah. Girl Scout camps, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Bridal showers.
Yeah.
Karaoke parties.
Yeah. And then the elves say, but what you really need is a hole in the ceiling. So let's knock that through. And grow some trees down here. Yeah.
It's weather permitting.
Yeah. Right, exactly. It used to be a nice indoor venue where you didn't have to worry about the weather. Right. And then those darn elves come along and knock the holes in the ceiling. And now you got to roll the dice. That's how it is. All right. Well, with that thought and theory, we should probably, it's getting late. We should probably leave. Thanks everybody for joining us. We will, we'll head up probably up, in the mountains up towards, Giant Valley next time, as we continue our exploration and get down towards the Fords, in the story, that is. As I say, I should be here next week, so I look forward to seeing everybody next week. Thanks for joining us. Good night, everybody. Thank you.
Bye.
I will enjoy. I hope to see some of you guys at TexMoot.
Yay.
See you guys later. Bye now.
Bye.
Thanks for joining me on this epic exploration of The Lord of the Rings and of Standing Stone's video adaptation of Tolkien's story. If you are having even half the fun I'm having on this journey, I hope you will consider supporting the project by donating at signumuniversity.org/fund.